First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
This is WJCT News 89.9 in Jacksonville.
Opinions expressed on the Friday Media Roundtable are those of our panelists and do not necessarily reflect the views of WJCT News.
Nicole has passed through, leaving behind lots of flooding in her wake. Voters went to the polls Tuesday, and the city has a new sheriff. Plus, will the city council sign off on new district maps that have been challenged in federal court? Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning. We are live from Studio 2. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, all the biggest stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. Join us. The number, 549-2937. Then later, we've got a preview of this weekend's Supergirl Surf Pro at the beaches. It's all ahead, but first this hour, it's Friday, and here to round up the week's news, we welcome here in studio Will Brown of Jacksonville Today. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see you. David Bauerlein of the Florida Times-Union back with us.
Good morning, Melissa.
Always good to see you. And joining us by AirLink, Tim Gibbons, editor of the Jacksonville Business Journal. Hey, Tim.
Good to be here.
Good to have you. Rounding out our fabulous foursome, Ann Schindler of First Coast News. Hi, Ann. Hi, Ann. Are you there?
Yeah, good morning, Melissa. Can you hear me?
I can. Thank you so much for calling in. I know you've had quite a busy week covering the storm, so we appreciate you being with us. And let's begin with our top story this Friday, Tropical Storm Nicole. Of course, it passed through our area yesterday. And you may feel like we're completely out of the woods, but there are warnings this Friday morning. Mayor Lenny Curry is warning people to be aware of high tide this morning. The risk for flooding at the beaches and along the St. Johns River is still not high necessarily, but still a factor, especially if you live in a low-lying area. You're being asked to stay out of the ocean and off flooded roads. Turn around if you see water. Don't try to drive through it. We begin the hour with a closer look at Nicole's effects, and in particular, discussing the flooding we've been dealing with. Let us know how your neighborhood fared. Give us a call, 549-2937. Send us your pictures, too. We've been getting lots of your pictures from across the listening area. You can drop those into First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. Ann Schindler, let's begin with you. You've been very busy covering the storm. Where were the worst impacts?
In our area, the worst impacts were to the south, in the Summer Haven area, Crescent Beach, and Volano Beach, particularly hard hit. Of course, farther south in the state, there was, you know, much worse damage. But yeah, we took a beating. And, you know, the dunes in Duval County also have taken a beating up to Brunswick, where we're still seeing flooding, and St. Mary's. So it's a pretty wide swath in this immediate area. Not as bad, some people say, as Matthew, but sort of similar in terms of the scouring that the beach took and the homes that you were already imperiled, you know, now really truly over ocean waters, which is a bit unusual, and a lot of road damage. We're seeing long stretches of A1A closed yesterday. Some of them reopened today, but they're really just kind of with immediate, you know, shoring up by DOT.
Let me ask you, yeah, about the A1A stretch, I think, in Volano Beach. We saw some video and images yesterday of that section of road completely crumbling.
It's interesting because if you ask officials in St. Johns County why it's important to renourish beaches in front of these, you know, expensive homes that some people think are sort of folly to build in the first place, they'll say, well, look, it's not just the homes, they're protecting a highway. And that's a main arterial, you know, between St. Augustine and Ponte Vedra. But that battle is kind of being lost, is clear. The road was overwashed and collapsed yesterday. And so, you know, whether that is, that whole area is, you know, ultimately going to be a sustainable highway and stretch of road without just this kind of constant depositing of sand and money. It doesn't look great.
Absolutely. Thanks for making that point. Will Brown, Jax Today, that is something that as Florida continues to deal with these big dangerous and ever more frequent storms, that very uncomfortable conversations are going to have to be had with local officials, with the state legislature, with whoever is governor in the future, about how much more money and resources we can keep throwing at these vulnerable areas that are eventually going to lose to the rising waters and the winds.
That's a really fantastic point. You know, I find it fascinating that we are going to devote a good bit of taxpayer dollars to rebuild these beaches, improve the dunes, protect the highway, as we should. Mm-hmm. And then you know, there's a segment of folks who are like, I don't know if we want to spend tax dollars on roads and development. I think that's really interesting in light of, I think it was, wasn't it just this Tuesday that St. John's County voters overwhelmingly said, we really don't want a sales tax increase, most of which would go to pay for roads and things like this.
Yeah. Tim Gibbons, our business editor on the line, when you look at the hard, cold numbers of this, the economic case, there's the short-term case, which is let's keep building along the coastline. And then there's the longer-term argument, which is this is not sustainable in some parts of the state.
That's always the problem. And we talk about the number of people who move to Florida, and obviously there is a economic boost when you have the population grow. You know, to some extent, the story of the past couple of years has been that huge in-migration coming into Jacksonville, and a lot of those people want to live in areas that that have issues. And so it's a complicated question. I mean, it brings the entire issue of how should we collect government money, what should the money be spent on, because you have people who are moving here because of a low tax base who then need those tax dollars to bolster the infrastructure in the areas they're moving to, which is a kind of interesting vicious cycle.
Yeah. And David Bauerlein, you know, when you see these images of houses, particularly in the Volano Beach section, sliding down into the sand, it's not very, it's not a comforting look. It's not something that reassures people about the long-term viability of some of these coastal regions.
Not at all. And, you know, A1A, I've driven that road, and it's one of those scenic roads. If you look at scenic routes of Florida.
Yeah, absolutely.
A1A road, yeah. And look out your window, and there's the ocean. And that's what the appeal is. People want to live as close to the water as they can. They're willing to pay more for that real estate. But the other side of it is we all end up paying more for that, too, because we're subsidizing those. This sort of rinse, you know, this wash, rinse, repeat cycle of it washes out the dunes and you got to pay to get the dunes back. And then it washes out the dunes. I mean, it's but the alternative is to just to have a buffer zone where nobody can build. And that's just
no one wants to be the politician that makes that call.
The whole Florida appeal, which is come to Florida and live close to the water. And by the way, you'll spend a lot less than you would if you were living in New Jersey and trying to make that same kind of lifestyle choice.
Absolutely. And then Ann Schindler, I know you have to go soon, but if I may, let me ask you too about another big story from Nicole this week, the flooding. We saw so much flooding again in Jacksonville. This is after Hurricane Irma, where the flooding was really biblical. And then Ian caused flooding across much of the state. Now, Nicole, once again, we're waterlogged. Jacksonville has a resiliency plan now and a chief resiliency officer. But dealing with regular flooding from these storms is going to become an ever bigger concern for this city, I think. And this wasn't even a hurricane when it came through. It was just a tropical storm.
Yeah. When we, you know, we're talking about sort of this most visible damage. If you walk through some of the neighborhoods that flooded from the outside, they may not look even all that different. But everybody's home that floods is, you know, a true level of destruction for them. And some of the neighborhoods that are flooding and will continue to flood with high tides for the next couple of days because the water is high and the river is already full. So, I mean, that's going to be like a daily tidal thing. And the reality is more and more that kind of flooding has less to do with extreme weather events and more just with extreme weather, which is what we're living with, you know, all the time.
Yeah.
There's places that we were in Davis Shores where the residents were living in their campers because of Ian, because their homes flooded out, and watched as it happened again, even as their repairs are underway.
Yeah, and folks pointing out Irma wasn't even a hurricane either when it reached Jacksonville. Listeners, too, are asking us to not forget the neighborhood of Kennight Drive in Jacksonville, Will, which got socked during Hurricane Irma. They're still trying to come back from that. And here we are now after two more storms since Irma. And there are neighborhoods in this city, underserved neighborhoods that don't have good infrastructure, that just get socked again and again by the water.
And, you know, that's a fantastic point. I didn't have the chance to drive up the Kennight Drive this storm because it's so hard. Not that it's hard to get there, but just how much water was that area was under inundated with. But, you know, I spoke with someone, a gentleman named Will Hill, ahead of Ian. And, you know, he has lived on Kennight Drive for years and his family's lived there for years. And I want to read directly what he said. He said, we always hear that what they are doing on the west side. We hear what they do on the south side. We hear what they're doing on wherever. But what do you do for the north side? That was his direct quote. Mm-hmm. And he firmly believes that people, not just the city government, forget about Northwest Jacksonville, forget about North Jacksonville. And it's a bit frustrating for him and other neighbors like of his.
Yeah, I mean, Tim Gibbons, we saw pumps getting set up in San Marco, of a really affluent area. Were there pumps set up in a neighborhood like Kennight Drive?
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly where the different pumps were deployed to, but I think that the broader question, the broader issue that you're putting your finger on is that Jacksonville has a long history of not treating its different neighborhoods equitably. And you look at like the area around Kennight Drive, where, as you've said, is suffering from multiple storms. And the city will make promises. The foreigners will give us money to fix a situation that just does not get fixed, which I think is probably more to a root issue in Jacksonville, that there are part of the cities since consolidation have not had the public investment that was promised. And so the baseline is so low that storm damage, anything like that, is damaging an area that kind of came in pre-damaged. So yeah. A lot of this is saying, as a city, are we going to actually fix the areas that need fixing? Are we going to fulfill the promise of consolidation?
Yeah, David Bauerlein, that's the question. And can the city's resiliency plan and new focus, can it meet this challenge?
It's a tall challenge. Kennight Drive, there is a plan, which is to spend money to buy out houses, create a buffer zone so that when this creek floods, it's not going to be in people's houses. That has moved very slowly. There's a plan to do the same thing in a neighborhood in the St. Nicholas neighborhood south of downtown. That has moved very slowly. These flood control projects or flooding projects, they move at a glacier's pace. There's a plan for San Marco to build a big pump station that's going to prevent the flooding that you see every time it rains heavy in San Marco Square area. We saw a lot of that. That's going to be a $45 million project. It's going to take a couple more years to do that. You've got the McCoy's Creek project, which is, going to help some neighborhoods along there, which are not wealthy neighborhoods, but that's tens of millions of dollars. And meanwhile, you're doing these projects to take time, and Mother Nature's doing its thing too, which is the water's rising, you have sea level rise, you have climate change. So it's this, in a way, it's almost like a slow motion race who's going to keep ahead. And the problems, there's just so much waterfront in Jacksonville that how do you come up with a resiliency plan that fixes everything? Water has its mind of its own in terms of how it flows.
All great points. And let's go to your calls now. Let us know how you made it through Nicole this week. 549-2937. Joseph in Riverside. Hi, Joseph. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. I would just like to add my thoughts on resiliency and hurricane impacts. I actually wrote an article for the most recent iteration of Folio Weekly about a town in St. Johns County called Summer Haven. It has been repeatedly washed out by hurricanes basically since it's been inhabited. And what we see down there is an insistence by the wealthy homeowners that the county come in and rebuild infrastructure like A1A, like Coastal Highway, so that they still have access to their homes. But it's a losing battle. Those houses are falling into the ocean no matter what, and we just keep throwing money at it. And I think that Florida has a chance to lead the way when it comes to resiliency. We will be the major state being impacted by things like sea level rise, things like intensifying hurricanes, and we can lead the nation in resiliency and green infrastructure to fight against that. And, you know, speaking about disparities, Summer Haven is a perfect example between a wealthy enclave and a place like Kenknight Drive, which gets ignored. Mm-hmm. Also, I'd like to say just very quickly, Ann Schindler, you're the inspiration that drove me to write and want to do investigative articles. All right. Thank you, guys.
Oh, that's great. Joseph, thanks so much for that. And Ann Schindler, you do have many fans out there. So nice to hear those kind words about you. And he referenced Summer Haven, which you've been reporting on this week as well.
Yeah, and interestingly, the Summer Haven portion that he's talking about, those homes on stilts, this storm also took a lot of the north part of Summer Haven. We're out there this morning, and they've done a lot of revetments with giant boulders, which are literally like tossed around the streets up there right now. And the northern part of Summer Haven is actually kind of an old historic little fishing area, Gene Johnson Drive and kind of that area. And it too, I think is, you know, not long for, I mean, in the long term, the short long term, not going to be sustainable. It's just that the ocean keeps coming and taking whatever their best effort is to keep it back. And it just gets more and more deteriorated.
Mary in Mandarin. Hi, Mary. What are your thoughts? Good morning.
Thank you. Well, in my neighborhood, every time it rains, even if it's not a tropical storm, we have flooding because we have a detention pond, which doesn't have any tributaries or anything. When it overflows, everybody gets flooded in their yards, the streets, and my yard in particular, because we have a storm drain in the corner and everything just comes up and it's disgusting. And that's it. It's the way that the developers in the city, I suppose, have decided to be able to build cheap. I mean, I did not grow up in Jacksonville, but it seems, I don't know if it's in older neighborhoods too, but in every single neighborhood, there's a new retention or detention pond, which they advertise as waterfront property. It's a lot less expensive.
yeah.
It's the truth.
That's right. Oh, Mary, do you have flood? I it's kind of gallows humor. We're laughing to keep from crying. Yeah. Do you have flood insurance, Mary?
We do not. We're not in a flood-prone area. We're not allegedly in a flood-prone area, but we decided that it almost came in our house with Ida, I believe it was, or I might be saying the wrong one.
Irma. Yeah, you know what I would say to you, Mary, and to everyone out there listening, and this is coming not from me, but from insurance professionals. Even if you don't live in a flood zone in this state, you should still buy flood insurance.
Absolutely.
If you can afford it.
Thank you.
Yeah. And thank you for the call. Charles on the west side. Hello, Charles. Go ahead.
Good morning, guys. You know, the buffer zone concept on Kenknight Drive is interesting. Some places they call it managed retreat. And after Hugo in 89, I believe they tried to pass a law in South Carolina to not let people build back in those beachfront areas. And I believe that went all the way to the Supreme Court in favor of the homeowners rebuilding. So it's going to be a very tricky thing for resilience officers to grapple with.
I think you're absolutely right, Charles. And I think the pain points are going to have to get ever more painful before we really have a real reckoning with this whole situation. Will.
We tend to forget that modern Florida geographically looks the way it does because of sea level rise. The Florida Peninsula, tens of thousands of years ago was much wider than it is now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, nature is going to retake nature's going to reclaim what is its own. And
yeah, that's right. And Tim Gibbons, before we move on, you know, listening to that caller from Mandarin saying that, you know, they didn't have flood insurance because they don't live in an official floodplain. Well, millions of Florida residents don't live in a flood zone, and they've been flooded in the last several years. So if that's not a wake-up call, I don't know what is.
Right. That is an issue that Florida has, though, of heating wake-up calls. You know, clearly climate change is impacting the state. You know, to Will's point, the idea that the climate is ever-evolving and its impacts are being felt. And what used to be a floodplain can change. And even if you're not in an official floodplain, it's not like there's a magic barrier around you. Again, the idea of we have so many people moving into Florida and they don't realize this. To them, mm-hmm. Oh, it's not in a floodplain, therefore they won't get flooded.
Mm-hmm.
Seems to make sense. And then the storm comes.
Absolutely. Again, I'll say it one more time for the people in the back. If you buy property in Florida, unless you live in a really high elevation property and you can check the elevation of your property, check it before you buy it. See how many feet above sea level it is. Unless you're at really high elevation, nowhere near a tributary, lake, stream, ocean, you should get flood insurance if you can afford it. It's our Friday roundtable. We're talking about the biggest stories of the week with Tim Gibbons, David Barreline, and Will Brown. The number to join us, 549-2937. All right, let's talk about the midterms. Locally, T.K. Waters, a former chief of investigations for the JSO, is taking over the top job. He got 55% of the vote Tuesday. Waters is a Republican endorsed by Governor DeSantis. He focused his campaign on increasing the number of police officers on the streets. Both DeSantis and the other Florida Republican at the top of the ticket, Senator Marco Rubio, won re-election in Tuesday's midterms. At the same time, another Florida man, former President Donald Trump, has been throwing insults at Governor DeSantis on his social platform, Truth Social. Of course, he's been banned from Twitter. And Trump is indicating he will soon declare yet another run for president. This even though Trump's endorsed candidates did poorly around the country this week. We're discussing the midterms now. 549-2937. The president also put on Truth Social that he used the resources of law enforcement to help the governor win in 2018. That was really eye-popping as well. David Barreline, let's talk about all this, beginning with our local race, the sheriff's race.
It was not as close as it might have thought it would be a few months ago. T.K. Waters won handily, and really it just boils down to it was a Republican year. Democrats didn't show up, massively
mm-hmm.
stayed home.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what happened. There was, T.K. Waters probably will be the sheriff as well. He's just serving out the remainder of the term
mm-hmm.
for Mike Williams, who had to resign because he moved to Nassau County. I would suspect T.K. Waters will be able to win in the spring as well. I'd be surprised if there's a formidable opposition to him. And some history is made as the second black sheriff in Duval County after Nat Glover. Nat Glover was a black Democrat, T.K. Waters a black Republican. And, you know, it's interesting that every candidate for sheriff this election cycle was a black candidate. So something's happening out there in that regard, some history being made. But it was not a close mm-hmm. race. Of course, Lakeisha Burden would have made history as the first black woman elected sheriff in Duval County.
That's right. She earned 45% of the votes. She was asked if she will campaign again in March and hasn't decided yet. Will Brown, you know, in the weeks leading up to the election, the third place finisher in the August primary, Democrat Ken Jefferson, endorsed Waters. Burton called into this program in the run-up to the election and said that Jefferson was promised a job by Waters in exchange for his endorsement. Jefferson has denied that. More than $4 million went into this sheriff's race. Unbelievable amount of money, and a lot of it, most of it, coming from outside this city.
That you're right. That is a lot of money. You know, my Jacksonville Today colleague Claire Heddles did some wonderful reporting all throughout the sheriff's race campaign. You know, speaking with Waters, speaking with Sheriff-elect Waters.
Yeah.
And speaking with Ms. Burton, as well as some of the other candidates. I never knew what to make of the promises of a job. I mean, that's something the cynic in me just believes that happens more than we know. This is just one that happened to bubble up to the surface. I mean, and frankly, that race was a lot closer than a lot of other races on the ballot on Tuesday. So, but to David's point about turnout, you know, when he said Democrats didn't show up, Mike Hogan this fall said he expected hoped for 65% turnout. It was 50.3% in Duval County.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was far less than 2018, and a little bit better than 2014 numbers, which I think was around 49.2 in the county, somewhere in there. So the turnout, regardless of one's party affiliation, was abysmal on Tuesday. It's a bit shocking.
Having these elections in off-year cycles, Tim Gibbons, rather than moving them to the four-year cycle when you have higher turnout, helps preserve the status quo in Jacksonville. And there have been repeated calls over the years to move these elections to the four-year cycle so that you have greater participation and more voters coming out. And those calls have been ignored.
Right, and not even to get into the you know, the election coming up next year, which is you know, not on any cycle. I mean, it's on a cycle, obviously, but entrenched power interests are going to be entrenched power interests, and maybe this is an even higher form of cynicism. But there's a little bit of yes, having when the election is will govern how many people come out. But the other thing that governs how many people come out is people coming out. And there is, I think you look across the country where there was a surge of youth voters in other areas where there were voters who made them their votes known.
Mm-hmm.
And you can blame the system a bit, I think, properly, but you can also blame people who we didn't really have any reason not to vote. There were not the restrictions that often get bandied about. You know, enough early voting days, polls seemed to be functioning pretty smoothly when I was driving around last week, you know, so the fault of not voting does seem to at least somewhat fall on the voters or the non-voters.
Yeah, thank you for that. And as I noted a minute ago, Florida got redder on Tuesday. Governor DeSantis won by about 20 points, won re-election over his challenger, Charlie Crist. Senator Marco Rubio easily won re-election over his challenger, Val Demings. Now, at the same time as Florida got redder, most other states rejected the Florida style of politics. Democrats are likely, possibly, going to hold on to the Senate, countermanding all expectations of a red wave. The House is still up in the air, the House of Representatives. And on the GOP side of the aisle, there are growing calls among Republicans to move on from Donald Trump. Republicans pointing out that Trump-endorsed candidates like Doug Mastriano, who ran for governor of Pennsylvania, and Dr. Oz, who ran for the Senate in that same state, and other candidates went down to defeat, rejected by the voters as too extreme. Now, at the same time, former President Trump put on his website Truth Social this week, said that when he was president, he sent the FBI and federal prosecutors to Broward County, Florida, to ensure a win for Ron DeSantis and Rick Scott. This morning, Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried, who lost her primary race for governor, tweeted out asking the Justice Department to investigate Trump's claims about the 2018 Florida election. David Bauerlein, never a dull moment in the state of Florida. I mean, this is just extraordinary. And we're hearing that former President Trump may soon announce another run for president.
I fully expect he's going to run for president. And the whole thing about what went on in the 2018 election, that was just mondo bizarro. And it's bizarre that we haven't heard about it before. So I don't know really what to make of it, but I'm glad that Nikki Fried said that, because you know, kind of got lost a little bit in the shuffle of the Ron DeSanctimonious and, mm-hmm. you know, he's just an average governor, show me no loyalty, et cetera. But that was a real bombshell. If that actually happened or if he tried to do it, that's worth the story. I'm interested to hear if that was just him spouting off or there's something to it.
Exactly. I mean, could this just be former President Trump trash talking, or did he really take these actions? Nikki Fried's tweet says, I'm sending a letter to the Justice Department this morning requesting an official response to the wild allegations made by a Florida resident last night claiming credit for the outcome of the 2018 election of Ron DeSantis and Rick Scott, Will Brown.
That makes the whole hanging Chads conversation look like child's play.
Yeah.
I mean, that is unbelievable that anyone would allege that, let alone the former president of the United States. I mean, even if you take the pure politics out of it, just the fact that someone alleges voter fraud in an election that close is mind-blowing. And then for the person who was the president of the United States at the time to say this happened, this is beyond uncharted territory. I mean, it also brings into a bigger question of, so much of what has happened, I'd say, over the last 5, 6, 7 years has been people throwing stuff at walls and seeing if it will stick. And allegations from, you know, Republicans, Democrats, political agnostics, and seeing, will this stick? And it makes it more difficult for people to know what is actually happening. Mm-hmm. And this is another one of those circumstances where even if there's no validity to this, or even if it's 100% true, it's going to take a time to investigate. And by the time that investigation concludes, the people, unless someone's a hardcore into politics, they may or may not care. And so I mm-hmm. think that's the bigger concern, is that there's so much stuff being thrown against walls to see if it will stick and if it will be politically beneficial to folks.
Yeah, absolutely right. And Tim Gibbons, you know, as Governor DeSantis, coming off this 20-point just about re-election victory in Florida, is garnering all the support now of major donors on the right, the media apparatus on the right. I'm talking about the Wall Street Journal and Fox News and other outlets, all lining up behind Florida's governor, trying to position him to run for the GOP nomination for president in 2024. But at the same time, at Mar-a-Lago in Palm Beach, former President Trump is going to do everything in his power to muddy up DeSantis. This is going to be most likely a bruising primary fight for the ages.
Yes. So I can't remember anymore if we're supposed to take Trump literally or seriously or which way that phrasing goes. But when he comes out with something like saying he sent the FBI in, you know, God knows what the truth is. Did he make a call like he did in Georgia and it took place or was rebuffed, or somebody told him, yes, sir, we're on that, and then didn't do anything? Yeah, there's no way of knowing. What we do know is that the conservative establishment rallied around a host of candidates during Trump's first primary, and that did not turn out well for them. So I think there's this, you read some of the stuff coming out of even the conservative media now, which is, oh, how can you have this intra-party fight? And, DeSantis obviously is the future, in the words of the New York Post. And I think there were plenty of people who thought they were going to cruise to the Republican nomination the last time that Trump won, and that did not turn out to be what happened. So it will be a bruising fight.
Absolutely. And Mike tweets the show, please also point out that DeSantis intimidated voters with his election police and put roadblocks in front of the formerly incarcerated who should have had their voting rights restored. His illegally gerrymandered congressional districts also handed more U.S. House seats to the Republicans. He's talking in particular, David Bauerlein, about the districts in our area, congressional districts 4 and 5. The governor's maps held through this through this midterm election, despite being challenged, and eliminated what are traditionally thought of as minority access districts in the state of Florida.
Yeah, for decades, Jacksonville has been represented by a Republican and a Democrat in Congress. So this will be the first time there's going to be two Republicans. And the reason is, there used to be one district that included the large black population, mainly in Northwest Jacksonville, used to go south to Orlando, and more recently it went west to Tallahassee. Al Lawson is still the congressman for that district, but they redrew it. He ran for a district on the other side of Tallahassee and lost. So I don't think there's a Democratic Congress representative north of Orlando now in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a redistricting that really paid dividends. And, you know, it's going to be really close in terms of who controls the House. And, you know, little things like changing this district so that it elected a Republican, Aaron Bean, overwhelmingly, because it was drawn in a way that favored a Republican, could make a difference in the balance of power in the House of Representatives as well. That's the kind of thing that wins a governor like DeSantis some bona fides at the national level with Republicans, that he was able to engineer that. Now, it's still a court case, and it could get overturned, so we'll see.
We'll see. We should point out that other states have engineered gerrymanders to protect Democrats and bolster Democrats. In particular, keep your eyes on states like Nevada, which have drawn the lines in such a way as to help Democrats, and that may also affect the balance of power in Congress. And on our Facebook page, Paula asks, how can Trump run legally, given all of these investigations into him, into his tenure as president? Well, as it turns out, Will, you can be indicted, you can be accused of all kinds of malfeasance, and you can still run for office. There's no law against that.
Just because you can do something doesn't mean you should. And that's, I mean, that's the best way I can put it, whether it's former President Trump running for president or a lot of different things in this life. Just because you can do something doesn't mean you should. Or does, and in the case of politics, doesn't mean it's good for other people.
And certainly the Republican thought leadership is making a concerted effort to encourage former President Trump not to run again. But based on everything we've seen from him up till this point, I doubt that he would listen to their advice. We'll have to see. But let's get back to some more local news. And by the way, the number to join us is 549-2937. Still some folks waiting on hold to talk about flooding, and I appreciate you guys calling in. But we do need to just round up a little bit more news from the week. Okay. The city council plans to vote today on new district maps for city council and school board races. Now, this is after old ones were struck down as unconstitutional racial gerrymanders. Yes, we're back to gerrymandering. But after several days of committee meetings, it's not clear the council has enough votes to approve these maps. Last month, U.S. District Judge Marsha Morales Howard struck down the city council and Duval County school board maps, said they were discriminating against black voters and segregating voters on the basis of race. Tim Gibbons, you know, this has just been a big old mess, and we don't know if it'll be resolved today. Your thoughts?
Yeah, no, I think in some ways it's been overshadowed by a lot of the national and state level politics, but clearly this is of vital importance to Jacksonville and to its future. And to, we started out the conversation talking about what needs to be done for different neighborhoods in Jacksonville. This is where that comes into play. The idea that what does your district look like, and do you have somebody on council who cares about you and wants to represent you? A lot of that comes down to what district you're in and how those lines are drawn. So it sounds technical. I'm sure a lot of people's eyes glaze over when they get into the weeds of this, but it's a true on the ground impact sort of thing that is vitally important. Whenever we talk about redistricting, shout out to Andrew Pantazzi, whose work on this has just been tremendous in covering every twist and turn of it.
Absolutely. So has your work, David Bauerlein, and our own Raymond Troncoso covering it. I want to give a shout out to everyone who's been trying to educate the public about this, including you. What are you expecting today?
So I kind of thought it was pretty much resolved where the city council was going to go with it, that they had decided they were going to go with a redrawn map that would change somewhat the boundaries for districts 7, 8, 9, and 10, which are in Northwest Jacksonville. They are not, the city council is not going to give what the civil rights groups that sued the city really want, which is a fifth district drawn in Southwest Jacksonville, that would be drawn in a way that it would really favor the election of the choice of black voters, which in Jacksonville is a black Democrat. It's a Republican controlled council. They're not going to go that way on it. So I do think there's still the matter then of what the judge thinks about the city's plan. There's still the matter of what the of whether there may be some resolution where the plaintiffs, the civil rights groups in the city, reach some out of court settlement, so to speak, where they join hands and go to the judge and say, here's our compromise. We're willing to both live with this. I think that's unlikely because there's such a split between the unity map the civil rights group have, which is let's have a fifth district that's geared to elect a black candidate to city council, and the city council saying no, because a black Democrat is going to be a Democrat. It's a Republican controlled council. They don't want to give another seat that's going to favor a Democrat. So.
549-2937, Omar on the west side. Hi, Omar. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning to you all. I just wanted to kind of make a correction. Now, from my understanding, the maps in Nevada were not drawn by the Democrats. The Republicans submitted a map that was overturned by the courts. So it went to an independent council, and they drew fairer maps. So that's what happened there.
I appreciate that. That adds some complexity to what I was trying to point out, which is that, yes, they are fairer maps in Nevada, but still slightly favoring Democrats, maybe not as lopsidedly as maps in this state favor Republicans. But at the same time, some states have gone toward independent redistricting commissions, because what we're watching here in Jacksonville is these politicians are getting to draw the lines themselves to benefit themselves.
An independent redistricting commission would benefit not just Jacksonville, but would benefit communities in this state and other states, as long as there's number of parties who can nominate folks to that independent commission.
Yeah. Okay. But Tim, you know, we're not likely to see independent commissions do this kind of work in the state of Florida for the time being, which is unfortunate, because whether it's a Republican or a Democratic gerrymander, incumbencies will use whatever tools they have at their disposal to protect their incumbencies.
And I think that's one of the one of the key things in the city council redistricting that has come up, of how blatantly and nakedly the council members are talking about, you know, picking their district, they're picking the voters who you know, will vote for them. And they're not even, you know, they're term limited. So they're not even, you know, unlike the federal offices where people truly are, I'm going to pick this group of voters because it will keep me in Congress forever. People, you're a politician, you don't, elections are hard and you might lose. So if you can get a district that is easy and you will win, that's what you want to do. But manifestly, that is not what the Constitution says should be the issue when it comes to redistricting. It's not let council people preserve incumbency. It's give voters a voice.
All right, folks. With all of that said, let's go around the horn and round up stories that might have missed your attention this week. It's appropriate that after Nicole, we're going to do a lightning round. Actually, we didn't get a lot of lightning this week, just a lot of rain. But I'll start. If you're planning a holiday road trip, you might want to think twice about heading out on I-95. A new report from The Zebra, the nation's largest insurance comparison site, says I-95 is the most dangerous highway in the United States, with the highest number of fatalities. Of course, it is one of the biggest roads in the United States, too, for what it's worth. Also, it's Veterans Day, thanks to all who've served. However, because of Nicole, the traditional downtown Veterans Day parade is canceled, unfortunately. They could have held it, actually, but out of an abundance of caution, they didn't. But thanks to all of our veterans. Will Brown, what's on your mind?
Well, since it is Veterans Day, let me shout out my younger sister, Ozia Brown, who served in the Air Force for 7 years and did 2 tours in Afghanistan. She's going to give me grief for that, but oh well. But the thing that really stood out to me this week is nowhere close to Jacksonville, the U.S. men's national team named its 26-person roster on Wednesday for the upcoming World Cup, which will be held in Qatar. 26 people, none of them are from the state of Florida, but the World Cup kicks off November 21st, and then there is going to be a number of parties in the town on November 25th for the United States-England game.
Nice. Tim Gibbons, what's going on in your world?
So we're working on a story about a marina that is planned for near downtown. Interesting people behind it, a super yacht captain, an event planner, and they're looking for something that they hope will be a destination. It would take, you know, probably 2 years or so to really build anything out there, but it's interesting to see downtown and how it's developing. Next couple of years will be fun to watch.
Yeah, absolutely. And David Bauerlein.
Well, Will mentioned earlier the St. Johns County tax referendum. It got overwhelmingly defeated in St. Johns County. This is a county where tax referendums go to die. And they have tried over and over again over the years. And that's a very, very conservative county down there. And it means that if they want a library card, they're going to get one from Jacksonville and drive across the county line, because there's all these bedroom communities and they just don't have a lot of services yet.
Wow. Yeah. Thanks for pointing that out. That was significant, too. And I've got two more notes tomorrow at 4 p.m. Tune in to What's Health Got to Do with It, looking at whether or not your doctor is fit to practice. And then today at noon, join me and my co-host Matthew Petty live across the state of Florida for the Florida Roundup. We'll look at the Tuesday midterm results and what they might mean for Florida's future. We'll also interview the first Gen Z member of Congress, Maxwell Frost, elected to Congress from the Orlando area. Gen Z coming into the halls of power. Look out. They're coming. Will Brown, Tim Gibbons, David Bauerlein, and Ann Schindler. Thanks, everyone, for being with us.
Thank you, Melissa.
We'll be right back.
Have a good weekend.
This week on Science Friday, we look at how states are handling a surge of RSV in kids.
RSV is the predominant virus affecting the state right now, and as usual, it's hitting the youngest residents particularly hard.
And a doctor prescribes how to keep our kids and ourselves safe, all on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
President Biden calls the midterms a good day for democracy and added a special thanks to the country's youngest voters who showed up big.
They're the best educated generation in American history. They're the least prejudiced generation in American history, the most engaged generation in American history, and the most involved.
We wrap up a week of shocks, surprises, and a few cliffhangers on the Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Mm-hmm. Welcome back. Well, the World Surf League's Air Force Supergirl Surf Pro comes back to the Jacksonville Beach Pier and Seawalk Pavilion today through Sunday. While the world's leading female surfers compete in the water, free concerts from major headliners, women's sports competitions, and a festival village will entertain everyone on land. The best part, all events are free and open to the public. We've got a preview as we welcome here in studio Lindsay Jacobellis, Supergirl Surf Pro Ambassador. Good morning.
Good morning. So excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
It's great to see you. Also with us in studio, 17-year-old professional surfer Sawyer Lindblad. Hi, Sawyer.
Hi. Nice to meet you.
It's nice to meet you. And I'm so excited to have you both here with us. This sounds like a great and fun event, especially after we got through yet another storm. Hopefully we can enjoy beautiful weather this weekend and have fun at the beaches. So, Lindsay, tell us all about this event.
Well, this is its second year here in Jacksonville, but overall, Supergirl has been happening for 16 years. We even have a snow side of it as well,
oh,
which
really?
Is awesome that we're developing every year. So this event just keeps growing and growing, and it's so wonderful to be a part of this event, to have that female camaraderie and to see how all these women are supporting themselves on all different platforms. And we don't just have surfing at this event. We have skateboarding, we have volleyball, soccer, and lacrosse. That's all right down on the beach or in the festival village. And everything is free. It is free to be watching this event. And for the skateboarding, volleyball, soccer, and lacrosse, it is free to enter. And it's just so inspiring to see all these different women on all these different platforms come together, support each other. And it's just something I never had growing up, you know, 20 years ago when I first started being in a male dominated sport in snowboarding. So to be a part of this transition is just so wonderful.
Oh, I can only imagine. Now, let me just let people know about your resume. You are a 5-time Olympian. You're a 2-time Olympic gold medalist, a silver medalist. You have won gold at the X Games 10 times. You are the winningest snowboarder in history. You are the oldest American female athlete to win gold at the Olympic Winter Games. Just an incredible athletic career. And so you're a role model now for the young athletes coming up behind you.
Absolutely. But Sawyer also inspires me. I occasionally see her out in the water at lowers and just what she's doing and pushing the next level for ladies for her generation, even though we're 20 years apart. It still inspires me to be pushing myself to see what I could be accomplishing in another realm. So thank you, Sawyer, for that. And it's this intoxicating environment that just keeps pushing you to be your best.
Now, Sawyer, you're 17. You're a pro surfer from San Clemente, California. You were the youngest Supergirl winner at the 2022 Nissan Supergirl Surf Pro. You want to add another title here this weekend in Jacksonville Beach. Tell us about why you love surfing.
I just love it because there's no other sport in the world where you're just so connected to nature, and being out there in the ocean, just surfing with the other girls is such an amazing part of this world. And I'm just so grateful to be traveling around the world doing what I love, and competing here in Jacksonville is going to be really exciting and fun. I'll compete tomorrow morning, maybe. And yeah, I'm really excited.
And how much does it help you and your cohort, people, young women your age, looking to make your mark in this sport, when you can be at these events with all of these other accomplished women? Because as Lindsay was saying, there didn't used to be this kind of pipeline.
Yeah, for sure. It's so inspiring to look up to Lindsay and all the other girls paving the way for women's sports, especially the women who are in the male-dominated sports. It's just really inspiring to see all of them definitely pave the way for us, the younger generation. And yeah, I'm excited to see where everything goes.
Yeah. And, you think of surfing as a male-dominated sport, but not as much as it used to be. And this is an event that I think showcases all the women that are just doing amazing things in this sport, but not just surfing, as you said. There'll be other sports.
Absolutely. Every year you see the bar being raised by women, and then that just fires up the next generation to see where they can take it. And, you know, we're seeing more aerial maneuvers out of females, and just the strength and raw power in the types of waves that they are surfing. And now they're, at Chopu surfing, and, I just see it. I'm like, no, thanks. I don't need to ever be a part of that level of surfing. But I love that women are pushing that level right now.
All right. Yeah. So with all of that said, this event kicks off today, but it's going through the weekend. Can you tell us a little bit about everything that's happening?
Absolutely. So Saturday and Sunday, it is an all-day affair, and we have the surfing heats throughout the day. And in the Festival Village, we have 12 free concerts. A lot of them are local performers, which I'm excited personally to see what the local talent is, as well as our main headliners. We have Smash Mouth, Modest Yahoo, Less Than Jake, and The Expendables. And again, these are free concerts. So you just have to get down to the beach, and everything is free. And we have all the tents that are giving away all the free swag. Of course, the most coveted Supergirl capes that everyone is trying to get their hands on.
Oh,
and those
cute.
Are great things for kids to get, signatures from all the surfers out there. So it's such a wonderful thing that's just taking just south of the Jacksonville Beach Pier and right in the Seawalk Pavilion.
Now, Sawyer, will the post-storm waves impact your game at all? Is that, or does it make it even more fun?
I think it'll make it even more fun. Definitely the waves will get bigger and have more power to them. Last year it was really small, so I think this weekend we'll definitely have some bigger, more powerful waves and more opportunity for us to show our skills.
Nice. And when do you compete?
I'm competing tomorrow morning.
Tomorrow morning, bright and early.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, best of luck. And thank you so much for giving us a few minutes. It sounds like it's going to be so much fun. Thank you, Lindsay Jacobellis, Supergirl, Surf Pro Ambassador and Olympic Champion, and 17-year-old pro surfer Sawyer Lindblad. Come on out to the beach this weekend and enjoy all of the competing and the music and the festival. Thanks so much, ladies. Have fun.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, everyone. Thanks also to our team, David Luckin, Heather Schatz, Brendan Rivers, Isabella Da Silva, Gary Autry, and Michelle Curram, surfing the news every day. I'll be back today at noon for our statewide show, The Florida Roundup. Join us then and make it a great Friday.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.